Hartman, truth in broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It's Monday, the 19th of May, 9 a.m. or 9:06 here on the West Coast, noon 06 on the East Coast. There is a concept at law called just cogens, or jus cogens. And basically, it's Latin for the higher law. And these higher laws are laws that no country really can legitimately or legally violate. Things like, broadly now, slavery, wars of aggression, genocide, and torture. The Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment says, and I quote, "No exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency may be invoked as a justification for torture." And yet at the same time, John Yoo of the University of California, Berkeley, has been doing just that. In fact, here's an interview where Doug Castle, a human rights activist, asked him, is it appropriate to crush the testicles of a person's child in front of them as a way of getting them to talk?
If the president deems that he's got to torture somebody, including by crushing the testicles of the person's child, there is no law that can stop that.
No treaty.
No, and also no law by Congress. That's what you wrote in the August 2002 memo.
I think it depends on why the president thinks he needs to do that.
So John Yoo says, first of all, there's no treaty, and then he says, secondly, well, it depends on why the president thinks he has to do it. In other words, he's basically setting this aside. The consequence of this, John Yoo, professor at the University of California, Berkeley, I sat at the National Conservative, the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference 2 years ago, and watched John Yoo debate Bob Barr, in which John Yoo was taking the position that George Bush could basically torture anybody he wanted, and that was just fine. And Bob Barr saying, this is, the conservative, the guy who led the floor fight for the impeachment of Bill Clinton, saying, no, this is wrong, and the conservatives in the room all applauding John Yoo. I mean, it was incredible. It was absolutely incredible. So anyhow, some 50 protesters, many of them clad in orange jumpsuits and black hoods, this is in the San Francisco Chronicle, to emulate the infamous photos of prisoners in Iraq, picketed UC Berkeley's law school graduation ceremony Saturday, demanding that the university fire Professor John Yoo for being the author of the memos, the torture memos that led, some would say indirectly, many would say directly, to the death of over 100 people at the hands of the United States in torture. And we don't know, we have no idea how many others. I mean, we just literally have no idea. And Ann Wiles, an Oakland attorney who with a National Lawyers Guild, she said, we want to see him fired and disbarred for being a war criminal. Academic freedom stops when you intend to harm or injure somebody. On the other hand, the University of California, Berkeley, is saying our guidelines are that we can only fire a tenured professor if they're convicted of a felony. And so, but they're not calling for, obviously, you to be convicted of a felony, so maybe we should. I wanted to get the opinion of somebody who's certainly been on the inside of this whole debate of whether or not a tenured professor can be fired and should be fired, and you know the political correctness and all that sort of thing. One of my heroes, a really great spokesman for the rights of indigenous people around the world, and somebody who has said some things that have been very inflammatory, and yet I think should, as a consequence of that, should cause us all to think. Professor Ward Churchill, longtime member of the Leadership Council of the American Indian Movement of Colorado, a founding member of the Rainbow Coalition of Elders, author or co-author of more than 20 books, over 100 journal articles. As of 2001, he was the most cited scholar in his field, in the field of American Indian Studies, employed by the University of Colorado for nearly 30 years, where he won the highest awards for teaching, scholarship, and service. Was fired in July of 2006 as a result of tremendous political and financial pressure on the university in response to a media frenzy about his comments on possible motivations for the attacks at 9/11. He's now suing the university for pretextual dismissal in violation of his First Amendment rights. His website, wardchurchill.net. Ward Churchill, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to be here. I'm glad. I thank you for showing up and talking with us about this. I'm curious about your take on John Yoo. Very much on the opposite side of politics from you and I. And yet he's a tenured professor. It seems to me that as a tenured professor at the University of California, Berkeley, he should have the right to say whatever he wants, but should he have the right to take a two-year leave of absence and basically participate in war crimes and then come back as if business was normal?
Well, no one would have that right. If he participated in war crimes and he's subject to prosecution, that's under international law, and it is treaty law, contra Professor Yu, as well as the statute on war crimes in U.S. statutory code. So it's both domestic and international law.
Right.
Jeff Colgan's would be brought to bear under certain doctrines, but there's statutory violation at issue here. And as I understand the position taken by the dean of the law school, Bolt Hall, since Professor Yu was not, quote, a decider, he shouldn't be. He should not be subject to prosecution, which is a nullification of the entire principle of the Nuremberg prosecutions of legal policymakers, judges, and so forth that occurred in the 1946-40.
Right. In the Nuremberg trials, many of the people who were not deciders, they were the people who provided the legal rationalizations. There was even one guy who published a newspaper who just, you know, stirring people up. I mean, it was the media was prosecuted. The attorneys were prosecuted. It wasn't just the deciders, to use your phrase. So
yeah, that was the phrase that was used in the memoranda explanation, if you want to call it that, as to why there would be no action taken on Professor Yu.
Right.
And why, in the opinion of the dean of the law school, there should be no action taken on Professor Yu.
Right.
But I would like to point out here that the whole premise that a faculty member can be acted on only in an instance could be terminated, tenure revoked, and so forth. I can testify directly to this.
Right.
The whole premise that that can only happen in an instance where there is a conviction, a conviction of a crime, is absurd.
Why?
I would suggest that there were no standards applicable to scholarship governing the comportment, the activities, and so forth of the legal professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and that's absurd.
So, in other words, you think that there should be that he should be it should be possible for him to be denied tenure because of academic violations?
Well, he wouldn't be denied tenure since he's already got it.
Or I mean, you know, have it stripped of him, be fired. Yeah.
Yeah, academic misconduct. If there is demonstrable misconduct, in other words, fabrication of evidence,
right,
misrepresentation of sources, and so on.
Yeah, and in fact, isn't
actionable.
Yeah, and isn't that essentially what happened to you? You know, there's a debate about whether it was trumped up and whether it was phonyized and whatnot, but that's how they came after you.
In my case, refuses to submit or accept the premise that the scholarly review of the points in my work to issue was taken with would be subject to the same standards. See, they were placed in a position where they could fabricate.
Right.
Simply make assertions gratuitously, offer no evidence, arrive at conclusions, and when those were challenged by competent scholars in the field, the university refused to subject that to same scrutiny for adherence to scholarly standards that were applied in an incredibly rigid fashion to me on the basis of fabricated evidence and so forth.
Right.
So we've got a different situation. Here we've got a basis for investigation on grounds of academic misconduct based in critiques that were put forth by Jordan Paust, among others, in entirely reputable law journals, in detail.
Pretty, yeah, and the president of the National Lawyers Guild, Marjorie Cohen. I mean, you know, it's among others. Yeah.
So there's
a double standard here. We have about a minute left. We're talking with Ward Churchill. WardChurchill.net, his website, by the way. Check it out. What then do you think that the University of California should do about Professor?
Well, independent of any legal action that might be taken, and personally I think it should be taken with regard to you, and not only you. That point's well taken. It's not only you, but certainly it includes you.
Professor Yu, not me.
On the basis that they're not prosecuting a sitting president this week.
Right.
That can come later.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and should.
But independent of that, the University of California Law School certainly has grounds to undertake an investigation comparable to my own. I would hope it displayed more integrity than that was undertaken with regard to me. But They have plenty of grounds for action at this point.
It could be done. It's legal. There's precedent, and it's appropriate. Ward Churchill, thanks for dropping by and sharing your thoughts with us, sir.
My pleasure.
WardChurchill.net is his website. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Should John Yoo be prosecuted? Should we have Nuremberg trials in the United States? Or simply bounced out of the university?
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Like me and you, so let the voice of freedom sing out through this land. This is our country.
21 minutes past the hour. You know, let me take this through a segue into a larger frame here, and another issue which has to do with Hillary Clinton as well. Speaking of torture, of the John Yoo torture memos and the torture that was, I don't want to say advocated by John Yoo, the University of California professor at Berkeley, but certainly the memos that he wrote authorized it. Now we know that there was this group, including Condoleezza Rice and Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, and that George Bush was knowledgeable of this, that sat around and literally on a case-by-case basis decided how hard somebody should be tortured, that these memos were handed off to the guy who was in charge of Abu Ghraib and in all probability led directly to those kinds of abuses, that sort of thing. Hillary Clinton on the floor of the Senate speaking to this issue. This is about a year ago, but this is germane to it, and it brings up the Clinton candidacy as well.
When General Washington led his soldiers across the Delaware River and onto victory in the Battle of Trenton, he captured nearly 1,000 foreign mercenaries, and he faced a crucial choice. How would General Washington treat these prisoners?
And clearly it would be different than John Yoo or George W. Bush or buddies.
The British had already committed atrocities against Americans, including torture. As David Hackett Fisher described in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Washington's Crossing, thousands of American prisoners of war were treated with extreme cruelty by British captors. There are accounts of injured soldiers who surrendered being murdered instead of quartered. Countless Americans dying in prison hulks in New York Harbor. Starvation and other acts of inhumanity perpetrated against Americans confined to churches in New York City.
So here you had George Washington dealing with an enemy who was brutal and merciless.
Well, you can imagine, the light of our ideals shone dimly in those early dark days, years from an end to the conflict, years before our improbable triumph and the birth of our democracy.
So what did Washington say to his soldiers about the prisoners that they had just taken hostage?
General Washington announced a decision unique in human history, sending the following order for handling prisoners. Treat them with humanity and let them have no reason to complain of our copying the brutal example of the British Army in their treatment of our unfortunate brethren. George Washington understood that how you treat enemy combatants can reverberate around the world. We must convict and punish the guilty in a way that reinforces their guilt before the world and does not undermine our values.
Amen. And very, very, very well said. And which brings us to this another issue for the hour, which is not only should John Yoo be prosecuted, but should Hillary Clinton be the vice president? There, in today's New York Times, there is an article quoting Geraldine Ferraro, who says that she thinks that Barack Obama is terribly sexist. She's also said that she may not vote for him. They quote another woman activist, a Hillary Clinton activist, saying that she absolutely positively would not vote for Barack Obama come the fall. There has been this, frankly, I think, corrosive But there it is, this very strong staking out of positions on the Obama and the Clinton sides. And I would suggest to you, regardless of her negatives, and I know that this is the big argument, is that Hillary Clinton's negatives are very high. They're very high largely among Republicans. That a ticket that includes Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton is a ticket that could win and would be a very, very strong ticket. And obviously, and as well, historic. It in some ways, it harkens back to John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. Here you had Lyndon Johnson, the old hand in the Senate, the older guy. I mean, here, you know, Senator Clinton is older than Barack Obama. The older generation and the younger generation, John Kennedy. You had Lyndon Johnson going into that Democratic race thinking that he had the thing sewn up. He had all the power in the Senate. He was the guy. He had the right to it. No. And Kennedy was a phenomenon, and he took it. And he took it from Lyndon Johnson, and then he reached out to Lyndon Johnson and said, hey, you want to join the ticket? Johnson said yes. Johnson was a guy who his credentials as a progressive, I mean Hillary Clinton is a hyper-progressive compared to Lyndon Johnson at the time. I mean, Lyndon Johnson had built his career basically being a white Southern racist cracker from Texas. And an arm twister in the Senate. And yet here's the guy who brought us the war on poverty, who brought us the Civil Rights Act, who reduced poverty in the United States by at least a third within 4 years, arguably cut it by half over the next decade, who transformed in very positive ways. I mean, if you set aside the Vietnam War, which is damn hard to set aside, I was out there in those protests getting tear gassed as we yelled, hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids have you killed today? But if you set aside the Vietnam War, LBJ was one of our most progressive and successful presidents. And so, you know, the idea of having a ticket with Barack Obama at the head of the ticket, Hillary Clinton as vice president, and then maybe 8 years down the road, Hillary Clinton running for president, to me, that seems like something that actually could work. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on who should be Barack Obama's vice presidential candidate, assuming that he gets the nomination. Increasingly, it's looking that way. Particularly after we saw 75,000 people here in Portland yesterday.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-302-2270. Point. Howard Dean made this point a couple of weeks ago in an interview. He said the real important person coming out of the Hillary Clinton Barack Obama primary is not going to be the winner. It's going to be the loser. And how enthusiastically and aggressively and effectively that loser campaigns for the winner to bring the party back together, because the party has to be healed. And you see these huge schisms forming in the party. And if the Obama camp is convinced that they really don't want or shouldn't have Hillary Clinton on the ticket, they should engineer a backroom deal with the Clinton camp to publicly invite her and have her publicly decline. And then make her leader of the Senate. Make her the majority leader in the Senate, in the United States Senate. Frankly, I think she'd do a much better job than Harry Reid. Or make her the next Supreme Court justice. I mean, there are so many things that she could do, or for that matter, simply, you know, like Ted Kennedy has for so many years. She can continue to be a real powerful and active voice in the United States Senate. But I think that this ticket, I think that this is a ticket that could work. You've got about half the voters out there saying yes, Hillary. And you've got a little bit more than half the voters out there saying yes, Barack Obama. And Obama is clearly the rock star. He's clearly the phenomenon. I mean, here in Oregon, they were both campaigning here over the weekend. And Barack Obama pulled 75,000 people to the edge of the Willamette River. I mean, just right up the house from where I live. It was amazing. It was amazing. So do we prosecute John Yoo? Should he lose tenure? Should he be investigated and prosecuted by the university for torture? And should Hillary Clinton be the vice presidential candidate on the ticket? A couple of issues on our plate today. Dave in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I saw that Barack Obama on CNN, or as they called it, the earthy crowd up there in Portland.
Yeah.
I thought that was amusing as they tried to diminish it.
Well, you know, and people talk about that, but you have to keep in mind, I mean, this is just like in this last ratings book, in the Adults 25-54, I beat Rush Limbaugh, and he's on a station with twice as much power, and they're both actually run out of this building. They're both Clear Channel stations. I beat him in the ratings in the last 3 months in the winter book. And people say, oh, that's because Portland's so liberal. It's the same way that they try to say about Barack Obama. Oh, it's because Portland's so liberal. The fact of the matter is, of the five counties in this area, three of these five counties voted for Bush in the last two elections. This is a purple. This is a swing state. This is a purple area. And you know, 75,000 people is a hell of a lot of people. But drawing huge crowds is not unusual for Barack Obama all over the country.
Yep, that was huge. John Yoo, I absolutely think that we need to go after John Yoo and everyone else on this. We can start with the war crimes, but this absolutely has to be done in America. I think going back to as far as Smedley Butler and the conspiracy for the fascist takeover over Roosevelt, Watergate,
yep.
Nixon being pardoned, Iran-Contra, with Watergate and Iran-Contra, if these people had been investigated, prosecuted, this would have never happened because many of them were the same folks or in very close orbits to people that would have were guilty.
Yep. Absolutely, but absolutely. A terrible precedent.
This deference to hierarchy in this country as far as the legal system has got to go, and they need to be held accountable, including right up to Crystal. People who get immunity because or impunity go out there and say, it was just an idea. I didn't tell them to act on it.
Yeah.
I mean, these are almost conspiracies of treason in my mind, and I think that there probably is some form of the law that could be explored to hold these people accountable.
Yeah. Well said, Dave. Well said. Amen. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama, listening on Sirius. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hi, Tom. As I listened to Hillary Clinton's comments about Washington at Trenton, it reminded me that as World War II, the European theater closed, and the Germans had the Soviets approaching on one side and the Americans and the British on the other, they often threw down their guns and ran to be captured by the Americans because they knew when they were captured by the Americans, they'd be given three square meals, some cigarettes, and be treated with human decency.
Yep.
And they also knew that if they were captured by the Soviets, they could probably expect either a bullet or just go to Siberia, like 100,000 German prisoners did from Stalingrad, where only 1,000 ever came back.
Right, and Rich, it wasn't just at the end of the war. It was actually throughout the war. There were a lot of Germans, not so many Japanese, but there were a lot of German soldiers who surrendered to Americans rather than fight because they knew that they would be treated decently.
And not only is it the right thing to do, but it's also the most effective thing to do because it increases the possibility of the enemy surrendering. If they think they're going to be tortured, they're going to fight till the death. And
yeah.
If they think they'll be treated humanely, it increases the chances of the surrender. Thank
yeah.
Tom. Enjoy your
spot
show.
On. Thank you, Rich, and you are so right. Mike in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tom. How you doing? One of my concerns that's going on, because I don't know if you remember in the West Virginia primaries, there were some comments made by some of Hillary's supporters that if Barack Obama gets the nomination, they'll vote for McCain or not vote at all. And this concerns me.
We're seeing this all over the country on both sides, frankly.
Right, yeah. And now, this is very concerned. I'm very concerned. I voted for Hillary in the Pennsylvania primary. However, if Barack gets the nomination, I'm 100% behind him. Because the worst possible thing can happen in this country, regardless of how you feel about either of the candidates, is to have John McCain as our next president. We've had 8 years of bad government. We don't need 4 more. And I urge anybody who, if Hillary's the nominee, I urge Barack supporters to support her. If Barack's the nominee, all of us who voted for Hillary, we need to support him, get behind him. Because, I mean, you got two good candidates here. You know, let's.
Amen. But there's talk now of a group of people Hillary supporters who are, basically talking about storming the convention. And,
yeah.
Let's bring these two groups together. That's my thought.
Exactly right. Yeah. I agree with you 100%.
Even if it's symbolic, even if it's the olive branch, you know, let's try to bring these two groups together. I mean, if the two candidates decide that they can't work together, you know, so be it. But let there be a, a visible and symbolic show of unity. And frankly, I think one of the best tickets. I can think of a number of excellent tickets. Obama slash, you know, fill in the blank. I can think of a number of Obama Edwards obviously comes to mind. But I think that Obama Clinton would be an excellent ticket. I really do. Sean in Washington, D.C. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. How you doing? I love the show.
Great. Thank you.
Tom, I totally disagree. I definitely do not think they should be on the ticket. I mean, the one, their messages are way too different. I really don't think that Obama...
How are their messages different?
Because Hillary wants everyone saying basically that she runs on experience. Okay, and that she... And she's still... And a lot of perception with Hillary is that, okay, she was in the White House before, and that was then. Obama's has this whole direction saying, I'm going to totally change Washington. I really don't think that Obama will be effective if you have both the Clintons.
Why do those two positions, why are they mutually exclusive? First of all, I would say to you that Hillary Clinton is increasingly talking about change. She's using that word a lot. She gets it that the country is ready for a change. And why can't you have somebody say, hey, I've got a lot of experience and I'm going to change
things? If you look at the polls, or the recent polls, both of them are beating McCain in a head-on-head race. So my whole thing is...
Sure, so put them together.
Like Jim Webb, and then, like you said, do a backdoor deal with Hillary. I mean, and then you talk about the Lyndon B. Johnson effect. I mean, Tom, I mean... That didn't work out too good for Kennedy. I just think that...
Well, actually, it did. You know, LBJ helped Kennedy carry Texas, and there are, you know, a lot of presidential scholars who suggest that without LBJ, he wouldn't have won. Hillary Clinton might help Barack Obama carry the South.
Well, that's true, but I think there's also a lot of rumors talking about how LBJ... Because I know I was reading a lot of stuff how LBJ and, you know, and Kennedy really didn't get along.
They didn't. They hated each other. They absolutely hated each other, and yet it worked. You don't have to like your president. You know, at the last couple of years of Bill Clinton's presidency, Al Gore didn't like him.
Yeah, that's true. I've heard you say on the show before, too, Tom. Now, you look at everyone who's voted for Hillary Clinton, and she's gotten outstanding numbers in states, especially the states that she's beaten Barack in. Tom, you cannot convince me that by the time Barack is named as our nominee and Hillary starts campaigning for Barack, of course you're going to have some people who will stop there and say, okay, I'm not going to vote for Barack. But you're not going to tell me, like, if she pulls 500,000 people in one state, that all 500,000 are going to vote for McCain.
I'm not trying to say that at all. We may be talking about a 5 or 10% margin here, though, and that could be a decisive margin in many states.
Well, that's true. But like I said, Tom, I love your show, and maybe listen to you a little longer, I'll be convinced, but I still just think...
Okay. On this one, we'll agree to disagree. Sean, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. John in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, John.
Hey, first I'd like to say that prosecutions of these war criminals, I don't view as punishment to them, them.
Right.
I view it as education for the rest of us, so that more John Yous don't get manufactured in the future.
I agree. It's part of the healing. It's part of the rebalancing. Just like the Nuremberg trials were not so much about vengeance, they were about correcting, righting a wrong, as it were. I absolutely agree.
Now, what I wanted to say about Johnson was that I've based on also what you just said, I believe that he did what good he did for this country.
Mm-hmm.
Was motivated more by compulsion than by desire, than preference of his. In the same way that FDR, I think, did it to preserve the semi-fascist democracy that we have. Smedley Butler might have been thinking about a complete fascist, more fascist. But you know, we're living in not a proper democracy.
John, I agree with you that there are a lot of flaws in our democracy, and to a large extent, it has become a corporatocracy. Franklin Roosevelt was a guy who came from great wealth, and who would have thought, you know, that he would be the champion of the underdog? I mean, he did a marvelous job. Frankly, I think LBJ did too.
Tom Hartman, speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The preacher man. and says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a going dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, a woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Hey, by the way, just a quick tip. Our contest today for the, I don't want to call it the best entry, for Sean Taylor, our executive producer, for Sean's favorite entry, or comment, rather, on our at TomHartmann.com on today's blog, today's show blog, will be a copy of my new book, Walking Your Blues Away. And we'll tell you a little bit about that later on in the program. And strange stuff going on out there in the world. Bob Schaefer, Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate from Colorado. Yeah, maybe he's crazy. Last week he aired a new TV commercial. Colorado's my life, he said, in front of a rugged mountain backdrop. Problem is, the rugged mountain that Bob Schaefer, the Republican candidate from Colorado, the mountain backdrop was Mount McKinley in Alaska. yes. Very, very strange. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Doris in Daly City, California. Hey, Doris, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I wanted to answer that about Kennedy picking Johnson. Johnson didn't have a bill behind him, so that's number one. And number two, everybody...
He didn't have a what behind him?
Bill Clinton. When he,
oh, I see.
He picked up Johnson, Johnson's wife wasn't Bill.
No, but see, Johnson, what Johnson did have, I mean, to the extent that Hillary has, you know, a some would say a secret ally, or, you know, a lot of power with her husband being the former president. Others see him as a liability. I think the same could be said of Lyndon Johnson, having been the Senate Majority Leader. He had both a lot of power, and he had used it in ways that a lot of people thought were a liability.
But it's not like Bill Clinton, okay? So,
yeah.
But then on the experience part, Bush had experience, and he took us into war. So after saying all of that, I want to say no on Hillary being the vice president. She's not a team player. He's running for change, and she would undermine him. He would get nothing done without fighting with her.
Well, Ed, thank you very much for your thoughts, Doris. And you may be right. You may be right. I don't claim to omniscience. It just seems to me that this is a good way to bring both sides of the ticket, both sides of the party together. Mark, is it Lamy, New Mexico?
No, it's Lamy, New Mexico.
Lamy,
New Mexico.
Sounds
bad, but that's the name of our town.
Good on you.
But,
hey, Mark, what's up?
Well, I was wondering, you know, all my life, I'm 57 years old, and all my life, the University of California at Berkeley has been the flagship of our most intelligent people. And what on earth is a war criminal torture monger like John Yoo doing on their staff?
Well, I think a lot of people are wondering this. This is why you had 60 people show up in orange jumpsuits for the graduation ceremonies for the law school at the UC Berkeley this weekend. And the story's up at the top of commondreams.org.
Is this an example of our nation being taken over by right-wing Nazis?
No, it's an example of the University of California, Berkeley, truly being a liberal institution and therefore believing in a diversity of opinion. The question is, has you stepped over the line of what's appropriate for diversity of opinion and into the area of, is he truly a war criminal? If he is truly a war criminal, then should he be prosecuted? And based on that prosecution, you know, if he's convicted, obviously he should be removed from the university. Or Churchill says that in his case, they didn't go after him for a crime he committed. They went after him because they didn't like the way some of the research that he did, which was published years ago, was handled, you know, that he didn't do the footnotes right or whatever. And he believes that it was trumped up against him, the university trying to get him out because they were getting so much flack from their right-wing donors, and that while it was used inappropriately and irresponsibly, you know, this charge of academic malfeasance against Ward Churchill, that there's actually an appropriate and genuine case that could be made against John Yoo at the University of California in Berkeley and should be. And so don't wait until he's prosecuted. Go after him for his academic positions.
Or go after the president and the vice president first.
Yeah, and the whole bunch of them. I mean, you know, and Condi Rice, who sat there, Dick Cheney, said the vice president, and Don Rumsfeld.
He's small potatoes next to the rest of them.
Except
Thank
that
you very
he's,
much.
You're welcome. Yeah, except that he's the guy who facilitated it. I mean, without his memos, they wouldn't have had the legal justification to do this. Scott, Orange County, California. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Just great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm doing really well, thank you. I would like to hear some discussion about the Electoral College mapping. It seems as though you never hear anything on the mainstream media about that. And very little is said about that, yet I think Hillary is clearly leading in that category, primarily because of states like California, swing states, et cetera. So I would just like to
hear... But see, that assumes that California would not vote for Barack Obama, which I think is a false assumption.
I'm sorry, if my phone broke up at the point at which you said something.
Yeah,
so,
you're saying that, you know, Hillary leads with the, you know, if you were to look at the electoral vote with California, for example.
Exactly.
That assumes that the Democrats in California wouldn't vote for Barack Obama, which I think is a false assumption.
Okay, I appreciate that. The other thing about the criminals that currently occupy the White House, I was thinking to something my wife talked about, the fishwives back in France and the revolt. And, you know, it would be nice to see something like that, because they are indeed criminals. They've completely shattered any aspect of the Constitution that was written way back when. And you know, if that's what it's going to take to see the Constitution upheld, then maybe that's what it's going to take.
Yeah, I agree. Heather in Seattle. Hey, Heather, we're just about out of time here for this hour.
Hi there.
Very quickly, comment.
Okay, I have
quick
two
comment.
Points I wanted to make. The first one was that the reason you're beating Ed Schultz, I'm a soccer mom, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the reason you're beating Ed Schultz is that most of us who used to love listening to him don't listen to him anymore, because he's been so shrill and so anti-Hillary for such a long time.
Heather, thanks for your comments. I really can't get into other shows. We'll be back. Kerry Lucas.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news.
Just privatize it all. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, there's nothing the government can do right. And besides that, those people who work for government, they're mostly union members, which means they're socialists. Holy cow, we can't have government doing things in the United States. Private corporations can do them so much better. Back in 1955, Milton Friedman, the libertarian economist from the University of Chicago, sometimes referred to Chicago School of Economics or Friedmanomics, the torch being carried to some extent today by Thomas Friedman. I don't think they're related, but in any case, in 1955, Milton Friedman advocated the idea of school vouchers. Of vouchers for people to opt out of public education. Reagan was the guy who, the first president to actually advocate this. And in 1990, Wisconsin became the first state to do it. That legislature, which was pushed, Tommy Thompson, the Republican governor, pushed through a program for vouchers for schools. And, well, the only problem, education reformers ought to resist unreflective support for elegant-sounding theories derived from the study of economic activity that don't produce verifiable results in the classroom. This from Saul Stern. This is a quarterly published by the Conservative Manhattan Institute. The Conservative Manhattan Institute looking at this saying, doesn't work. Doesn't work. The Bradley Foundation, another conservative institution, it hasn't worked out like we thought it would in theory. And yet folks are still pushing vouchers for schools. Kerry Lucas is with us. She's the Vice President of Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org is their website. And Kerry, you're still beating the drum for vouchers for schools.
Things I think is really funny when I hear people talk about this and talk about, you know, criticize the idea of school choice. is just this idea that this is somehow this bizarre, bizarre kind of mysterious notion that we would give people some options, because this is how it works on universities. This is how it works in almost every other area of life. We don't have government go and assign, okay, you've got to go and use this grocery store, you've got to go use this doctor's office. But it is, that's how it works when it comes to K through 12 school, and there are consequences to that. And most people realize when we have less choice, that's a bad thing. So innovative ideas of how to change that really it should be. I don't know why this is so controversial or is made to sound so devious.
Well, let me explain it to you. And I think that your example of colleges is a great place to start. You point out, and I think correctly, that colleges compete for students based on the quality of their academics, and they charge whatever they can charge, and there's a relatively open marketplace in academic colleges, although it is somewhat, and actually I'd say probably substantially, distorted by locally supported community colleges and state-funded universities like Michigan State University, Oregon State University, things like that, that get money from the states. But nonetheless, the problem is that in the United States, unlike Germany, France, Japan, all of the Scandinavian countries, most of the European countries, in the United States, there is not free public education after 12th grade. In other words, there isn't free college for everyone. There is free college for everyone in Germany. And so there are German universities that are entirely funded by the government, as well as universities like the equivalent of Harvard that get very little funding from the government. So I think your analogy doesn't work with regard to higher education, because in the United States with public education, we have free public education for everybody. And then when you say that this is a matter of offering choice to people, I would submit to you that what you're doing is you're offering some choice to some people, particularly the wealthier people, people for whom, the voucher plus an additional $5,000 or $10,000 lets them get, it's basically a discount on a really nice private school. But it's diminishing the choice for people in communities where the amount of the voucher doesn't actually pay for the cost of education, or the vouchered schools are just as bad as the public schools.
Washington, D.C., and about the situation we have here when it comes to our public school system.
Yeah, and I know that 80% in a recent Zogby poll, over 80% of Washingtonians, people who live in Washington, D.C., said that they didn't want a voucher system for their schools. Instead, they wanted their public schools to work.
Well, that's interesting, because I think that if you talk to the people, you just had Marion Barry here, one of the radical, very far left former mayors of Washington, D.C., came out for vouchers, and this was a man who is nothing if not an advocate for the poor. Here in D.C., it's pure lunacy to talk about there being a lack of funding in the nation.
But see, Marion Barry is not an elected official in Washington, D.C. right now.
He is. He's in the council.
He's on the council again? Okay. I knew him when he was the mayor there. Dick Gregory took me in and introduced me, I think he's a great guy. But the actual representative of Washington, D.C., Eleanor Holmes Norton, who's
she's
an opponent of this.
Who is still a kowtow to the unions and opposes
and the majority of voters.
You now have the mayors is for it. You basically have, and this is entirely a Democratic controlled city, and you have everybody here is basically now starting to realize, gosh, I live in the district. I have two little kids, and under absolutely no circumstance would I ever send my child to public school in Washington, D.C., because they're absolutely abysmal. They spend, something close to $15,000 a child now, but no one who has any means at all sends their child to a public school in Washington, D.C. That's why Bill Clinton famously decided, okay, he opposes school choice for the poor families here in Washington, D.C., but when it came to Chelsea, he was going to pony up $25,000 to send her to Sidwell Friends.
But see, there's a reason for this, Carrie.
That's a luxury that wealthy people have. The luxury that more people exercise is something that I'm sure your listeners are going to recognize in their own lives.
But there's a reason for this. And let's you're thinking that the reason is that people don't choose another school. But the actual, if you look, for 20 years, we've had this experiment going on. As I said, it started in Washington with Tommy Thompson. And what they found, and the evidence is there, and it's from conservative think tanks. Conservative think tanks, the Manhattan Institute, the Bradley Foundation. Let me just finish the sentence, because I'd love to get your thoughts on this. The evidence shows is that it's not the choice of school that determines the quality of the outcome. It's not how much money is even spent on the school that by and large determines the outcome. It's not the geography of the school. It is the wealth of the parents. The children who come from poverty are more likely to have bad outcomes, even if they're dropped into Choate, you know, the prep school that George W. Bush went to. Whereas children who come from intact families of middle means or wealth tend to do better even when they're dropped into underperforming public schools.
You know, there's certainly, I'm no doubt that kids with intact parents are going to do better than kids with families.
I'm talking about wealth as the major variable, not just family.
Fine. Socioeconomic factors play a huge role in this.
It's the biggest role.
I'm going to have a liberal moment here and say, I don't think we should focus solely on test scores. I think there are other things, and what I want to question is, why is it that we accept the idea that everybody should be able to exercise choice? Right now, when a middle-class family decides where they're going to live, chooses a home, chooses an apartment, makes a decision on what community to live they go to, the first questions are always about schools. That's location, location.
Sure.
And schools are a big part of that. It is just poor people. It is the poor people living here in Washington, D.C., who have absolutely no means to change schools unless they are given something other than location-based schooling. There have been numerous studies that have shown that there is no system you could create other than assigning kids that is worse in terms of
encouraging
segregation and encouraging...
No, I don't disagree with you.
Okay.
Let's take this to the bigger picture. if the biggest variable in the outcome of a child is whether or not their families are middle class, is whether or not their families can make it, is whether or not their parents, you know, with one paycheck can actually raise a family, then why don't we be tackling poverty?
Well, you see, I think, but you're going to have it. There's a big statistical. You're making a statistical mistake there and assuming what's the causation. I mean, if you gave everybody
yes, and I'm quoting both progressive and conservative think tanks that the biggest variable is poverty.
Okay, but
so let's stop poverty.
It's not, but I don't think that. I think that you can't just say, okay, I'm going to give everyone $1,000. It could be that poverty is associated.
You don't stop poverty by giving people money. You stop poverty by giving people good jobs. And it's conservative economic policies and trade policies in particular that have destroyed the middle class in America and are continuing to destroy the middle class.
Okay, well, I can tell that you want to move this into away from school choice because it's obvious that
no, what I'm saying is that school choice is almost irrelevant if you don't treat poverty.
Okay, well, but when it comes to that's a conversation for another time. I'm happy to debate trade with you again, which I think we have in the past. But I think when it comes to this basic idea of whether or not you look at someone here in Washington, D.C., a poor family, whether or not they should be allowed to be given a D.C., it's about an $8,000 voucher, which covers the cost of your average private school, whether or not they should have that or be stuck in the terrible public school, I think that most people recognize that this is an issue that resonates with parents. They should have that choice.
Yeah, and I would say that it's going to further ghettoize the schools of those people who can't use the... Yeah, well, interesting conversation. Kerry Lucas, IWF.org, the Independent Women's Forum. Thanks, Kerry, for dropping by.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Pretty good, actually. 21 minutes past the hour. By the way, our caller at the very end of the last hour, in my brain, I was translating what she was saying into Rush Limbaugh, who we beat in the numbers here in Portland. And, you know, otherwise I wouldn't have let it go on. Let me get back to this whole issue of privatization. The privatization of vouchers. The privatization of our schools. School vouchers are a step in the direction of privatization. This is why Milton Friedman, back in 1955, was an advocate for this. This is why Tommy Thompson did it in Wisconsin. This is why it's been done all over the country. As I said, there has not been a single case where it has demonstrated that for the community at large, vouchers have been a good thing. In fact, what happens is that the schools that very often the public schools end up on the short end of the stick, they get, it's an excuse for defunding them or lowering the funding on them. So why do it? Well, because it provides an opportunity for private for-profit corporations to get into the education business and take more taxpayer dollars. What we're seeing here is one of the most massive shifts, what we've seen since Reagan came into office, since the 1980s, is one of the most massive shifts of taxpayer revenue into the hands of private for-profit corporations, CEOs, and stockholders in the history of this country. You'll recall that during World War II, Harry Truman was a United States senator. He was the Democratic senator from Missouri, and he got up and started railing against companies that were profiteering off World War II and attacking President Roosevelt for allowing it to happen. So Roosevelt said, fine, create a commission, investigate this. And the Truman Commission was formed, and Harry Truman and started holding hearings, and they put people in jail for profiteering off the war, off World War II. The idea that any company would use the public trust, the public commons, for profit was obscene. Well, Reagan changed all that in 1980. You know, he came along and basically said
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
You see, the government is bad. Government can't do anything right. And so, therefore, we should hand everything off to private corporations. Now, why would anybody say that? Well, because, hey, if you're a stockholder in a private corporation, you can make big bucks. And it's not just education. The Wall Street Journal, on the May 17th issue, I guess this would be the Saturday edition of the Wall Street Journal, two of the capital's best-connected companies have reached a $2.54 billion deal that showcases the lucrative market for carrying out sensitive military and intelligence work on behalf of the federal government. The Carlyle Group, whose roster of advisors once included former President George H.W. Bush, is buying a majority stake in the U.S. government business of Booz Allen Hamilton, Inc. Now, how much is this? Booz Allen, just this one company, is, you know, it's a consulting firm and an accounting firm. Just the one division of the company that deals with defense contracts is now bringing in $3.5 billion a year in revenue. Now, these are things that traditionally were done by bureaucrats or by people in the military, by people who were making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, who had good pensions, who were union members, and who wore the green eye shades and had nice, boring jobs. And now, instead, we're outsourcing this to private corporations where you've got middle management making $200,000, $300,000, $500,000 a year. You've got senior management making tens of millions, in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars a year. You've got stockholders skimming 10, 15, 20% off the top to pay themselves dividends, on which, by the way, they only have to pay a maximum 15% income tax. Because if you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, even if it's a Booz Allen dividend check, the maximum income tax you will ever pay on that is 15%, and you don't pay Social Security tax on top of that. It's a very, very sweet system. And the Wall Street Journal, you know, lays all this out like, isn't this wonderful? You know, nowadays, Carlyle is likely to strike business deals with foreign governments as it is with the United States. On Wednesday, Carlyle announced a deal with the government of Shandong Province in China that will give the firm a first look at deals in that region. Carlyle also has a major investment from Abu Dhabi fund Madhubala Development Company, which bought a 7.5 stake in Carlyle for $1.35 billion. So here we have private corporations making a profit with your and my tax dollars. Why was this article about how wonderful this is for Booz Allen and Carlyle and not about how many hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars in tax dollars are going to be paid for dividends and CEO salaries and upper management salaries that are absurd by government standards to do work that used to be done by the government? Well, it's privatization, after all. This is the school voucher equivalent in the defense industry of what we're talking about in the schools. Let's just privatize it all. Let's make sure that some millionaires and billionaires make out very well, thank you very much, because they're really the ones writing the rules. They're the ones running the think tanks. They're the ones who are putting the talking points forward on TV. They are the talking heads on TV, now that we're in an infotainment and star world, you know, run by big corporations that are the corporations who are benefiting from this in many cases, like GE and NBC, huge defense contractors as well. I mean, it's like a dog chasing its tail. And who gets screwed? You and me, the taxpayer. As taxpayers, we're paying a fortune for this kind of work compared to what we used to pay when boring government employees used to do it. The conservative world, it's working out very well for a small elite. The rest of us, toast.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
If it came along, everyone that knew him knew which side that he'd be on. He never was a hero for this county's shining light, but you could always find him standing up for what he thought was right. He'd say, "You've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything."
Standing for liberty, democracy, freedom, the U.S. Constitution, every day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year, in our sixth year of this program here, noon to 3 Eastern, 9 to noon Pacific time, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, Stephanie in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hey, Stephanie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Great to talk to you. I listen to you every day.
Thank you.
Love the show. I was just calling to respond to the lady who was on the phone earlier, the guest,
mm-hmm.
about school systems and not having any choices. And I just wanted to brag on my school system a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Our public school system in Winston-Salem, Forsyth County, North Carolina, we have a zone program. It is based on your home location, but within that location, you've got five different elementary schools to choose from that mm-hmm. they'll bus you to.
Hmm.
Outside of that, you can apply to go to any of the schools in the school system, plus there are magnet schools. So,
right.
I mean...
And none of this requires vouchers, and none of this basically puts money in the hands of individuals to give it to private for-profit corporations who happen to be in the school business.
Exactly.
Right. And
so,
yeah.
Personally, my son was in kindergarten, and we didn't like the school he was at. We changed. We
yeah.
found a better school, and I've been very happy with it. So,
yeah, I'm all in favor. Thank you, Stephanie. Yeah. I appreciate the call. I'm all in favor of parents being able to choose which school their children go to. We've raised three kids. I've seen this, and I've worked with schools. I've been a consultant to a number of schools, many of them in inner cities. And I'll tell you, the biggest problem that we have in our school system in America right now is not in the school system. It's in the neighborhoods around it. The biggest problem we have is poverty. And we need to be attacking poverty in the United States. We need a war on poverty like Lyndon Johnson declared, and we need rational trade and industrial policies that bring jobs back to the United States rather than shipping them offshore so that we can, because the best anti-poverty program in the world is a job. Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will.
How you doing? I'd just like to comment on one quick thing. And a lot of times, I know that's a great system in North Carolina, but that's not the case all over the country. And if I'm a if I'm a single mom and my school system is terrible, I would love to have a choice to be able to send him to a different school than the one that I'm in. And I don't know, I guess it depends on your innate view of, I guess, capitalism and government, but I don't know that it's necessarily a bad thing to have private companies running what would be government programs if they've proven to be more efficient.
I'm not opposed to it. Where I'm opposed to it is where our tax dollars, which, as libertarians like to point out, are taken at the barrel of a gun, are literally taken
right.
by force, where our tax dollars are being transferred to for-profit corporations. If somebody wants to put their kid in a private school and pay for it, God bless them, let them do it. I did it with Louise and I did it with one of our three children for 2 years, I think it was, that our son went to a private school, but we paid for it. I mean, it's that's That's an option for some people, for some kids, and for some kids it's necessary. But that's a whole different thing from saying, you know, let's fix all of our public schools. If we have a commitment in the United States, if we really and truly believe in the idea of free public education for all children, it has to be a free, quality public education. And what vouchers do is they erode that. They cut into that. They encourage the growth of for-profit schools and which will, in many cases, and I saw this in Atlanta when we were down there, in many cases will have standards, entry standards that keep out the kids that are going to drive down the grade, the overall grade point average in the school. And the consequence of that is that you get schools that are, that go, yes, we're the private school. We take vouchers. And oh, by the way, we've got, you know, 96% graduation for college. Well, the reason why is because they're doing their intake very selectively. And it's got nothing to do with vouchers or private. But they're able to make money using our tax dollars. And that's my problem is using our tax dollars to make money. That's where I think it's wrong. Dennis in San Jose, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Dennis.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I haven't heard it mentioned, but I believe that there would be corruption would pop up. You'd have some guy with a doctorate degree, whether he printed it or wherever it came from, would start his own little school, collect $1,000, you know, give $1,000 kickback to the parents, and then warehouse the kids until the government finally got around to busting him. And you can't do that with young minds. You can't just warehouse them. And I believe that as slow as the government would work, and as much as these liberals don't want the government to work, it would take them longer to catch them.
Well, the experience, Dennis, the experience has been, and again, I point to conservative think tanks, you know, like the Hoover Institution. The experience has been that when you have school vouchers and when you have for-profit schools competing with public schools, basically two things happen. One is that in many cases the for-profit schools produce a better result and the public schools start to deteriorate very rapidly because the best students are being creamed out of them. All right, Dennis, I gotta drop the call there because your background noise. But anyhow, the best students are being, you know, the cream is being skimmed off the top and dropped to those schools, and the public schools are left with the most problematic children, number one. But number two, the thing that's driving the whole problematic children is not the presence or lack of vouchers, or for that matter, the presence or lack of the amount of money that's being spent on schools. It's the socioeconomic background of the kids. Children who come from severe poverty in the United States. We're talking severe poverty. Children who come from severe poverty in the United States are less likely to perform well in any school, regardless of vouchers, regardless of money spent, regardless of whether it's for profit or not for profit. That is the main variable. And so that's what we need to be doing. Anyway, a lot of other things on the table as well. You know, should John Yoo lose his tenure? Should he be sued? George in Sunnyvale, California has some thoughts on that. Hey, George.
Hi, Tom. I hope your day's going okay.
It is. Just great. Thanks.
Well, I'm calling about this John Yoo thing. I normally don't even call. I listen to you a lot, but I don't bother getting involved in this. But this is made to be a big deal, and it's quite simple. A person with tenure is not allowed to walk around. Can you imagine a scientist walking around telling students that the earth is flat when we've known for over 3,000 years that it's not? He can have his credentials taken. It's a real simple process. Mm-hmm. And tenure, you know, there are.
And that was the point that Ward Churchill was making, was, you know, just look at the scholarship. What he's saying is contrary to the Constitution, and this is a guy who's a professor of constitutional law. He shouldn't be teaching it.
Absolutely. He's not teaching it correctly. Can you imagine when these parents that spend $40,000 to put one of their children through law school turns around and finds out they were taught incorrectly? What kind of lawsuits are going to come up against Berkeley then?
Yeah, yeah. Good, excellent point. Thank you very much, George. I appreciate it. Chris in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Just great. What's up?
Sorry, I was taking off the speakerphone.
Thank you.
I called earlier about the you were suggesting having Hillary as the vice president for Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm strongly against that. I know you're kind of pushing for that, and I don't agree with it. And it's not, first off, it's not a sexist thing. I think, for, you know, Democrats tend to be more open-minded. Liberals tend to be. I don't think any of us are voting against her because she's a woman. I'm ready for a woman president, but I think it's more of a factor of the way she's run her campaign, the negatives that she's undermined Obama's. It wouldn't make a good fit. I mean, it's like you talk about appeasement. It would be kind of a being forced on Obama.
George Herbert Walker Bush referred to Ronald Reagan's economic policies as voodoo economics.
Right.
You know, Bill Miller, who ended up running with Barry Goldwater, referred to Barry Goldwater as an extremist.
But what would be the advantage over, say, making Edwards? You know, she's talking about the white working class won't vote for him. She keeps tearing him up on that.
I think Edwards would be a very strong candidate. I'm not suggesting the only person who should be considered is Hillary Clinton. What I'm saying is that she has been in this race long enough, and she has won nearly half the vote, however you count it, you know, popular delegates, whatever. She's got a lot of people who are very passionate about her. And even if the two of them decide that they can't work together and don't want to be on the ticket together, I think there should be a public display of his offering and her turning it down, or
right.
his offering and her taking it, and, you know, depending on what's the best thing in the minds of both of these candidates and the party and their, you know, I mean, they need to do the internal politics of it. All I'm saying is to just basically, you know, turn your back on her and walk away. If Barack Obama did that, I think it'd be very destructive.
He wouldn't do that. I mean, you've seen how he's been very cordial, and he hasn't brought up any negatives against Hillary, very minimal, only to kind of defend himself. There's a lot of issues we all know that are out there that he could have brought up, which he's stayed away from. And, you know, I think he'll keep it cordial. I think you're right. He does need to show the opening, but I think it really aggravates me when I hear Clinton supporters say they won't vote for him. The only reason I wouldn't vote for Hillary is if they forced her, if the superdelegate stole it and made her the candidate, I would definitely not vote. And obviously, I don't think that's going to happen. If she wanted,
but see, that's the thing. I mean, any Democrat who says I definitely would not vote means that you're voting for McCain, Chris.
Well, I wouldn't vote if they stole it. That would be
but
as bad.
If you don't vote, you might as well vote for McCain. I mean, you're not voting as a half vote for McCain.
Right, which that wouldn't be so bad if you look at the alternatives. If so, I'm going to vote for somebody who's doing
No, that's terrible. John McCain is going to appoint right-wing cranks to the Supreme Court. He's going to continue
right, and then that becomes as bad as the Republicans saying vote for us because they're going to outlaw abortion. It's the same theory that, oh, you better vote for them. You know what? They're not going to outlaw abortion. I mean, I want liberal judges, but I'm willing to take a chance that they're going to steal the election. Now, I don't think we're going there. I don't think we have to talk about that. But that's the only reason I wouldn't vote for Hillary. I don't dislike her. But
yeah.
Obama,
it's just, you know, I got it, Chris, and I appreciate the call. But it just, you know, whenever anybody in their conversation finally gets to the point where they say, and therefore I won't vote for fill in the blank, Obama or Hillary, at that point I go, whoa, we have done some, you know, and you can pin the blame anywhere you want, but damage has been done to this party. It needs to be healed. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week.
Welcome back, my friends. Oh, John McCain says that, doesn't he? I'm not going to stop. I'm just not. Ellen Ratner's with us, one of my dear friends and one of my favorite people in the world, and for whom I not only have affection as a friend but also tremendous respect as a professional. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. And Ellen, what's going on in the world today?
Well, first of all, I am at the Republican walkthrough in Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
Getting ready for the Republican convention before I wing my way out in your direction, where I'll see you in the morning, I'm sure.
Are they going? Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing you tomorrow. Are they in Minnesota? Are they going to figure out a way to cover over the Larry Craig Memorial restroom so that when all the Republicans fly in, they don't notice that? And also, are they going to, like, what, put cardboard over the bridge that collapsed as a result of, you know, 20 years of Republican infrastructure policies?
Yeah, they got big problems here. And, of course, apparently there's a shoeshine guy that's giving tours of the Larry Craig Memorial Bathroom.
I know. Carl Wolfson, who is the, you know, co-host with me on our morning show here on AM620 KPOJ in Portland, flew through that, through the airport there and the shoeshine, and met with the shoeshine guy and had his picture taken. And the guy actually, yeah, he's right there by the Larry Craig Memorial Bathroom and he's giving tours. It's a major tourist trap now. This is going to be a tough one for the Republicans.
Well, I think they're going to certainly get some write-ups about it. Meanwhile, today there have been write-ups now about the fact that Senator Byrd, who is a superdelegate, is going to endorse Obama. And the Republicans have been not from the Republican Party, but, you know, some of the affiliated, non-affiliated sites have been saying, former KKK member.
Right. Byrd was the man who stood on the floor of the Senate before the vote to authorize the war and said, you know, we've seen this movie before. I mean, those weren't his words, but he was so passionate against that resolution.
Well, in his statement, that is exactly why he says that he endorses Obama.
Yeah. Even though he's the other senator from West Virginia, right? I mean, he's just
right
for Clinton.
That's right. Rockefeller and him. And, of course, Rockefeller is not so good on the FISA laws, as we know.
Yeah. And, yeah, absolutely. He's trying to get the telecom community.
And speaking of Republicans and McCain, apparently they're, and it's sort of buried on the Internet, but it is there. There is apparently an email that was left out of a Senate report on Abramoff that the McCain folks knew about, and certainly McCain. It involves Governor Riley, then governor of Alabama, and his connections with Abramoff, but somehow that never came to light in a 300-page report. So that has certainly been a big focus at this point. And speaking of McCain, he gave a speech today in Obama's hometown. Senator Clinton came out immediately, as actually did Obama, but talked about that there cannot be $100 billion in new tax cuts and that $4 billion more giveaway to the oil companies. So she really took off on that one.
Interesting.
Senator Lieberman wrote to the YouTube people today and asked them to take off the branded Al-Qaeda videos, which I actually think he may be right about. And apparently there's several Al-Qaeda videos that are branded that way and left for anybody to partake on YouTube. Kind of interesting, particularly given YouTube's policies of not putting certain offensive videos, et cetera. Republicans also came after Nancy Pelosi today on what they call the Pelosi premium and how gas prices are the highest they've been for 12 years in a row. And the Supreme Court came out with a few decisions today, and one of them is, let me just get to my Supreme Court decisions quickly here, has to do with, what did I do with them? One is that there were bonds. The Kentucky Supreme Court said that it was okay it was not okay to tax, to give tax-free bonds. And this is municipal bonds. And the Supreme Court said, because that interfered with the Constitution and the credit commerce part of that, and the Supreme Court said no, that would be still okay. And so that was a 7-2 decision on that. There was also a 6-3 decision on long prison terms, longer prison terms for people who had 3 previous convictions. The Supreme Court upheld that 6-3. Then there's a complicated case on child pornography. That went 7-2. Somebody claiming the law was too broad. It applied to somebody, and they said that this pornography law could even apply to mainstream movies like Titanic. The Supreme Court did not find for that.
Interesting. Well, quite a variety of things coming out of the Supreme Court today.
Very much so, and as you know, as the last few weeks come in here, we're going to be getting more and more varieties.
What's the latest? I know you've been following the situation in Burma. What's the latest with the government there allowing?
It turns out that the special envoy who we talked to at the United Nations actually was there over the weekend, and the Secretary General has been invited. They finally answered the phone, and the SG Secretary General will be going there, I believe, in a day or so.
So
is it going to be a dog and pony show, or is he going to have the ability to travel around the country and bring aid workers with him?
Well, no, it's going to initially be a discussion that he has with the Burmese government, and he may be able to visit, but it certainly, usually they let us know if the press is allowed to travel with the Secretary General. We may be allowed to travel, but I don't think Burma's going to let us in.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I agree with you that you're speculating, at least the speculation that you reported, that they are, that they're covering up 20 years of major atrocities against their own people. But time will tell. Ellen Ratner. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow, Ellen.
You got it.
Here in Portland. Thank you. And coming up next, Cliff Schechter on The Real John McCain.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, who is the real John McCain? Cliff Schechter raises this question, and it's almost schizophrenic, the answer. The real McCain, of course, the title of the book by Cliff Schechter. Cliff Schechter, a veteran campaign strategist, political commentary, political analyst on CNN and MSNBC. And his new book, The Real McCain, he also maintains a website over at firedoglake.com, cliffschechter.firedoglake.com. Cliff, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Tom. How you doing?
Great, great. I've been reading your book, The Real McCain, Why Conservatives Don't Trust Him and Why Independents Shouldn't. And it's absolutely fascinating reading, from the first chapter where you talk about his becoming a beer magnate. And I thought it was particularly interesting your comment about how he was singing in the Hanoi Hilton. And John Kerry, of course, didn't do anything close to that. But there will not be a swift boating of John McCain. Whereas if John Kerry had said some of the things McCain said, even under duress or torture, you can bet they would have gone after him. From that to his marrying his second wife 6 weeks after canning his first wife and inheriting a beer fortune that made his political career, to his battles on the floor of his fight with Rick Renzi and he's just a lot of and then his positions on war. It actually, some of his positions on war, if they were his positions now, you'd say, you know, this is a pretty rational guy.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, is the schizophrenia of John McCain.
Yeah, he'd accuse himself these days of waving the white flag.
Yeah.
Because back then, you know, in 1990, when the Gulf War was about to start, he went and came out and he said that, that, you know, we couldn't even think of trading American for Iraqi blood, which was a
right. Well, and even before that, as you write in your book, the real McCain, you talk about how he was opposed to Ronald Reagan sending troops into Lebanon.
Yep, he was opposed in Lebanon. He was opposed and very harshly criticized Bill Clinton in for putting troops in Bosnia, for putting troops in Somalia and Haiti. I mean, he was a completely different man, and he was in a lot of ways. And so, first of all, thank you for the kind introduction and for, you know, for reading the book. But I guess that's the thing, is people are finding this out from my book. It's kind of sad that they are. It's because it's almost like there's this whole chapter of McCain's early career that has just been ignored. I mean, you don't hear about the Keating Five anymore, and you don't hear about how different his positions were on most issues. And, you know, of course, it's only gotten worse. I mean, he's flip-flopped on everything from being against Bush's tax cuts because they were disproportionately for the wealthy, his words, and budget busters. That's where he was on them in 2001 and 2003.
Mm-hmm.
To abortion rights, which, you know, when he came out in 99 in interviews with CNN and the San Francisco Chronicle and said that we couldn't think of overturning Roe versus Wade because it would force women into dangerous operations.
Which raises an interesting question, Cliff Schechter, and that is, let me give you a little background on this. I've seen the YouTube videos that are out there floating around of Barack Obama 8, 10, 12 years ago, I don't know how long ago, making a very eloquent case for single payer health care.
Yeah.
And which is not his position right now. His position right now is, you know, a national health care program, but certainly not a single payer program. And I think that, you know, the political calculus here is that to come out in favor of single payer health care right now, at this point in a campaign, would be political suicide. It's the kind of thing that can be done by somebody once they hold office, but if they did this before they were holding office, the wrath of a multi-hundred billion dollar a year industry would come down upon their heads. And so I see those old videotapes of Obama pushing for single-payer health care, and I think, you know, I'll bet he, at least he knows the arguments. And I'll bet if he becomes president, we'll have a good shot at single-payer health care. And I wonder how many people, perhaps reading your book or seeing the old videotapes of John McCain being in favor of a woman's right to have an abortion, being opposed to interventionist wars, being opposed to the Republican tax cuts, are thinking, you know, he's just taking the positions he has to take as a Republican, but actually once he gets into office, he might turn back into that good guy that that we kind of liked.
Yeah, I worry about that, because the truth is that, you know, 99, again, was a period for McCain from about 98, 99, when he decided he was going to run for president, through 2003, and that's the real McCain. You know, the name of the book comes from the fact that, you know, the guy really is somebody who decides what he's going to do based on political calculations and based on who he's angry at that moment, usually in that order. And during that period of time, he was very angry at President Bush for the campaign that had been run against him in 2000, and he was setting himself up for an independent run in 2004. Short of that, as you probably know, he approached John Kerry about joining his ticket. So what I try to make sure that people know is that, yes, he was much more sane on international relations way back when, but on most other things, he was much, much more right-wing. And he's only changed really during that period of time, that 4 or 5 years, again, from about 98 or 99 to about 2003, because it served him to stand up and say he was for a patient's bill of rights and join John Edwards. And it served him to join John Kerry and say he wanted CAFE standards, you know, and that kind of stuff. But the truth is, if you look at his history and you look at his relationships with lobbyists and with the corporate right of the GOP, if you look at a guy who's unbelievably, you know, far right on social issues, that's really much closer to where John McCain is. And,
yeah,
that, and I think people should fear that more and not think that he's going to go back to being a moderate. He'll go back to being a right winger.
Right. And you know, you have to really read the whole book to get that, though. I mean, it's and I don't mean that as a criticism of the book. I mean, it's just that McCain has been so all over the map on everything, so many different ways and so many different times. One of the other things that is really startling to me about John McCain is how lobbyisted up he is. You know, there's got to be a phrase like sort of the lobby equivalent of lawyered up, you know, how people get lawyered up. Is there a phrase for that, and how would you describe it?
If there's not a phrase for that, one should be invented to talk about John McCain. I mean,
yeah,
you know, when you're talking about these super bundlers that put all this money together, there at last count I had, there were 66 of them for McCain, the guys that Bush calls pioneers, you know, that raise ungodly sums of money. Then when you throw in the staff, you're talking about, I think the what I saw out there, campaign Money Watch, was 112 of them who are intricately involved in his campaign.
Lobbyists.
And, yes, lobbyists. And they're lobbyists for very, very bad places and interests. They're when it was coming out, a lot of this stuff was coming out a month or two ago, it was, okay, they're telecom lobbyists, which, you know, if you believe that people shouldn't be spying on what you're saying, and net neutrality, other things, that should worry you enough. But we're not even talking about that. We're talking about his top advisor, one of his top advisors, Charlie Black, having, you know, lobbied for Somalia and having lobbied for interest for Ferdinand Marcos.
And from, you know, Burma and, you know, Myanmar.
Yes, and Tom Loeffler, who just left his campaign, a former congressman, you know, had the biggest single payment by a foreign government to his lobbying firm, $7.9 million, I think, between December of 2005 and November of 2006 from Saudi Arabia. Remember, where 15 of the 19 hijackers came from, where we know a lot of bin Laden's funding has come from, and they didn't, you know, of course, we haven't done anything about it. We decided to invade Iraq instead with all those wonderful connections, as we all know, that existed there. People should be worried, you know, that these lobbyists are there. The reform label is one that is out there, like a lot of the things that McCain gets himself labeled as, just to cover up weaknesses of his from Keating on forward. You know, we found out in that New York Times article, and I reported even further than that, the relationship with Vicky Eisman. But whether that was a personal relationship or not, it doesn't matter. The relationship was such that he was flying around on a corporate jet with her and doing the bidding of her clients. He was doing the same thing for Keating. You see these patterns again and again with McCain, that where corporate jets, lobbyists, and writing letters to regulators and pressuring them all come up again and again. And so people should be very concerned about that.
And it's not a coincidence. And really, we shouldn't be so worried about whether he's having a sexual relationship with this lobbyist as the nature of the financial and lobbying relationship.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's the one that's going to affect all of
that's
us.
That's the real scandal.
About about the personal relationship.
Yeah.
It's like sitting there and she's asking him to go and pressure cable markets to open up and allow our clients to go in and control content so that we don't, you know, we're getting one line from a few different cable channels in a certain market. That's what I'm concerned about.
Right. We're talking with Cliff Schechter, his new book, The Real McCain, Why Conservatives Don't Trust Him and Why Independents Shouldn't, and I would add, and why progressives should run screaming in the other direction.
Exactly.
Cliff, we have about 30 seconds left. What's the elevator speech that I should give to you know, friends or relations or coworkers who are thinking of voting for John McCain?
You should tell them that John McCain will be a simple continuation of the Bush years, except that there will be a closer connection to lobbyists, a guy who's temperamentally unfit for the office, and you'll just obviously see everything that's gone bad get worse. I mean, that's what I found in everything I looked at.
Is this the guy that you want to have his finger on the bomb, the guy who has a long history of not being able to control his own temper, of being irrational?
Yes. That's exactly right.
And of saying whatever the people who pay him the most tell him to say.
Yep, you said it better than me, Tom.
Okay, John McCain is the title of the book. Cliff Schechter, the author, Why Conservatives Don't Trust Him and Why You Shouldn't Either. Also, cliffschechter.firedoglake.com for his blog. Cliff, thanks a lot for writing a great book and for coming on our program.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, our number, tomhartman.com.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The hour. Just a reminder, Sean's watching the posts over at tomhartman.com on the blog for today's show to pick out her favorite, which we'll tell you about in about 20-30 minutes. And the winner will win a copy of my book, Walking Your Blues Away, How to Heal the Mind and Create Emotional Well-Being, a book I wrote with my psychotherapist hat on. And actually, I think it's a groundbreaking, breakthrough, brilliant book. I can tell you, there's a few books I've written that are not all that great. You know, Beyond ADD, for example. Don't bother buying it. But this is a book that's you know, I have 19 books in print, and there are some that I think are really, really good, and there's a couple that I just wrote them because the publisher said, hey, we need another book from you this year. This is a breakthrough book, Walking Your Blues Away. Michael in Fairfax, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I had a couple comments, if I could. One is about the Hillary Clinton you know, being the VP nomination, the other on John McCain. With Hillary Clinton as the VP, the negative thing about that, I think, is the fact that right now there would be nothing that would really cater to the ultra-right wing to go out and vote, the ones that aren't really too, you know, feeling too great about voting for John McCain. That would really bring them out.
Well, that's the conventional wisdom, is that Hillary Clinton will energize the Republican base. I'm not so sure that's true. I'm just not. The Republican base is right now very demoralized with John McCain. I think the thing that is going to determine whether or not the Republican base turns out is who John McCain picks as vice president, not who's on the Democratic ticket. They're gonna and the bigots and the right wingers on the Republican ticket, on the Republican side, the base, that part of the base, are going to be just as offended by an African American running as they are a woman. And it's, I mean, you know, it's just, there's that, those voters are gone. This is my take.
Right. Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I am a Republican, and I can see what you're saying at some point, because actually, as a Republican, you know, I like to listen to different shows and get different perspectives. And one of the things about with the right wing and with John McCain is one of my going over to that point with John McCain is one my wisdom with him is. Instead, to be in the middle, John McCain's actually more towards the middle. I think that's why everybody's kind of working towards the middle than Obama.
I mean, he's obviously, in my opinion, going to be the nominee. And even though I really have to be honest with you, the guy who just called in, the political information, I don't mind. It seemed to me like, obviously, it wasn't an objective piece. It was, he was going after anything you find, because the way he made McCain sound is like the answer, nothing good. You know,
well, his Cliff Schechter's book, The Real McCain, is an anti-McCain book. I'll tell you that right up front. It's a book that says, hey, wait a minute, this guy is not what he says he is. He's been all over the map, and mostly what he does is he behaves in, on behalf of people who pay him money. You know, he right, does well, what the lobbyists tell him to do.
But isn't he, I mean, to me, McCain, as opposed to Obama, would, even though begrudgingly, would cater to both sides a little bit better. You know, if you want someone that's going to make both sides somewhat happy in some issues, he would be, in my opinion, more of a candidate than Obama, who would only cater really to one side, like, for instance, McCain. The big
but Obama's not taking money from any of those interests that are largely funding McCain's candidacy.
Right. But, I mean, Obama's got negatives and McCain's got negatives. My point is like...
What are Obama's negatives in your mind as a Republican?
Obama's biggest negative is, one, his inexperience. Two, he's got no real, middle-of-the-road views that I see. Most of the views that he's come out and actually been able to tell me, because most of us just don't know what they are, is in a pretty left-wing, ultra-left-wing grouping, which is fine. I mean, that's fine. Everybody's got what they believe in.
So the fact that he's in favor of taxing people who earn over $200,000 a year for Social Security, having Bill Gates pay the exact same amount that you and I pay in Social Security taxes as a percentage of our income, the fact that he's in favor of national health care.
The top 2% already pay over like 80% of our taxes. I mean, that's a fact.
That's because they're making more than 90% of our wealth.
Right. So they are, but that's what I'm saying. So to me, it's, I mean, you're sitting there saying, okay, well, they're making 90% of our wealth, and they're paying 90% of our taxes, but now we want them to pay 95% of our taxes.
No, it's the other way around, Michael. I'm sorry to correct you, but the fact of the matter is that...
I'm just saying it's pretty, in the middle of the road. My point was, you can bring up different points about different issues. I'm just saying with John McCain, for instance, you would bring up that John McCain would bring out ultra-right judges. The only reason I disagree with that, and actually as a Republican, I wish he would, but he's not, is the fact that, I mean, a lot of his things he's come out, like McCain-Feingold, I don't think he's really going to come out with judges that would come out and say, well, that's unconstitutional, because most right-wing judges would. I don't think he's going to actually appoint judges that will be so right-wing that would actually overturn some of the things that he's actually come out
with. So are you going to vote for him or not, Michael?
Am I going to vote for him?
Yeah.
I really don't. I mean, yeah, I probably would.
What if he puts like Sam Brownback on as his VP? Then you'd be reassured?
Well, Steve, my thing is with Obama, though. You know, I mean, talking about Obama's VP from before, I really think that Obama should really pick somebody more from the industrial Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Not somebody, because that's where he's weak compared to Hillary. Is if you look at Ohio, Pennsylvania, maybe even Michigan.
People have been talking about Ed Rendell, for example. Michael, I appreciate the call. We're out of time. It's the break at the bottom of the hour here. But thank you very much for the call and for listening to the show. 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour. Strange stuff going on, as they say. Yeah, well, George Stephanopoulos calling John Boehner out on this.
The Democrats are having some fun at your expense this week because they look at your slogan, Change You Can Deserve, and say that's a slogan for Effexor, an antidepressant. Here was Congressman Steny Hoyer, your counterpart.
Change You Deserve, of course, is a trademark for an antidepressant. It does have side effects. It can make you sick. 82% of Americans have indicated they're sick and tired of the policies that have been pursued by the Bush-Boehner administration.
Shouldn't you have seen that coming?
Listen, I could have used an antidepressant last night, I gotta tell you.
Yeah. Mr. Boehner is crazy, I suppose. Anyhow, police say a trailer loaded with 14 tons of double-stuffed Oreos has overturned, spilling the cookies in their plastic sleeves into the median roadway. This is in Morris, Illinois. So, for our listeners, I don't know how far that is in Carbondale. It's 50 miles southwest of Chicago. Okay, great. So, for our listeners on WCPT, get in your car! Free Oreos! No. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Len in New York City. Hey, Len, what's on your mind today?
Hi, you were talking about Hillary as vice president before. And I'm going back to Obama's own words during the campaign when he was saying, you know, if experience alone were the test of who should be president, then Joe Biden surely should be the person that everyone chooses.
Yeah, and rightly so. Hillary's, and again, I'm not here to be an advocate for Hillary Clinton or for Barack Obama, frankly. I think that my listeners are intelligent enough to make up their own minds. But experience is not the only basis upon which she's running her candidacy.
But I think he cited Biden because, you know, listening to Obama speaking, his positions are very much like Biden's, who's got, you know, very high credentials with everyone. You know, it's very hard for anybody to speak nastily against about him because they just don't have anything.
Well, and except for the bankruptcy bill.
And I have a feeling that he's the guy he's going to pick. And if he's not going to pick a Biden, then he's going to ask Biden, well, if it's not going to be you, who should I pick instead? Because, you know, he wants someone there to backstop him completely, give him all the credentials of having, you know, sound judgment despite his not being there as long as Biden or anyone else.
No, good point. And I've met Joe Biden. Joe Biden is a very, very impressive guy. He is incredibly smart. He really knows foreign policy. Joe Biden, and he does fight back, and he does kick back. By the way, Warren Buffett just endorsed Barack Obama. They are coming in fast and furious. And in fact, by the way, I wanted to share this with you. MoveOn.org has a new ad out about John McCain and Charlie Black. I just have to share this with you. It's so well done.
John McCain says we're fighting in Iraq to plant the seeds of democracy. But the firm of his chief political advisor, Charlie Black, made millions lobbying for the world's worst tyrants. Ferdinand Marcos, who executed thousands of his own citizens in the Philippines. Zaire's Mabuto, who publicly hanged his opponents and looted his country's vast mineral wealth. And rebel leader Jonas Savimbi, a mass murderer who covered Angola with landmines. Charlie Black said he didn't do anything wrong. John McCain should tell Black he did. Call John McCain and tell him to fire Charlie Black. MoveOn.org political action is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
Now, here's where it gets a little awkward. Charlie Black's company is owned by a company that is run by Mark Penn. So who's going to fire Charlie Black? I don't know. This is the weirdness of Washington, D.C. But it's a great ad. And, enough said. Matt in Napa, California. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Wanted to kind of disagree with you on the idea of votes for anybody other than a Democrat as a vote for McCain.
Okay.
You know, it just seems like you're against the circular firing squad idea, but yet that's kind of a provocative statement to the people that feel there should be other choices besides the Democrats, I think.
I'm all in favor of other choices. I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000. I mean, I'll put it right on the table. But I lived in Vermont at the time, and Louise and I decided to split our vote. She voted for Al Gore. I voted for Nader. And the reason I voted for Nader was, A, I loved his policies, and, B, I wanted the Green Party to get matching funds for the next election. And the Green Party has done amazing work all over the United States. Every single city, we've got over 300 communities in the United States with instant runoff voting, which is, in my opinion, the greatest hope for the future of democracy in America. And it's always as a result of the efforts of the Green Party. But, you know, that said, we have to understand that what Madison was talking about in Federalist Number 10, where he was freaked out about the possibility of the emergence of political parties, is that because we're one of only five fully modern democracies in the world that doesn't have proportional representation. And of those five, two of them, New Zealand and Australia, have a variation on instant runoff voting. So it's us and Canada and Greece, basically, because we're, you know, we're one of the few countries in the world where it's all winner take all, first past the post. So if you have more than two political parties, if you have three political parties, you could have somebody with 34% of the vote running the country. If you had four political parties, you could have somebody with 26% of the vote running the country. That's not small D democratic.
I just want to add, you know, before Nader in 2000, we had discussion where, you know, there were votes in safe states that, it, you know, seemed safe, and it seems like that discussion's now off the table. And I just think comments like, you know, vote for a third party candidate is vote for McCain continues this just black and white perspective and really limits the choice in democracy.
Well, if we have states, if there are states where it's, you know, really, really clearly obvious, I'm not opposed to people voting. Frankly, I think everybody should vote their conscience. They should vote whatever they think is best. And strategic voting is a part of that in my mind, you know, voting. But I thought David Cobb did it right. David, and I should, you know, disclaimer, David is a friend of mine and he's a brilliant, brilliant guy. And David, when he ran for the Green Party in 2004 for that nomination, he came right out and said, if you're in a purple state, if you're in a swing state, don't vote for me, vote for John Kerry. And if you're in a state that's solidly blue, that, you know, that is going to go for Democratic, then please consider voting for me. And I wish Ralph Nader had run that kind of campaign in 2000. You know, I think he actually probably would have ended up with more total votes at the end of the day.
Well, I don't mean to make it specifically about Nader. You know, it's just progressive third parties in general.
Well, my response was to the guy who says, you know, I think that this guy said he liked Hillary Clinton, and so if Obama was the nominee, he wouldn't vote for him, or maybe it was the other way around, and therefore, if that's the nominee, he's not going to vote at all. And my point was, not voting at all is the worst thing that you can do. Not voting at all is very much a vote for John McCain. If you're progressive, or if you're a Democrat, or if you're a liberal, it is very much a vote for John McCain. But point taken, Matt. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Tom in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Tom.
Well, Tom.
Yeah.
Hey, Tom.
And Tom,
I'm a big fan of yours. I got to meet you at Borders last year.
Great.
In Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Hey, Tom. I was just wondering. I heard you talking about vice president picks.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what you thought of Jim Webb.
I think he'd be brilliant. He brings the military experience. He's smart. He's articulate. He's a good speaker. The only downside of Jim Webb, in my mind, and maybe you know, maybe you're more familiar with him than I am, but it seems that the only downside would be that to the extent that the argument against Obama is his lack of experience at the federal level, Jim Webb is a newly elected U.S. senator as well.
True.
So, you know.
I know. I just wanted to run it by you, buddy.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot for the call, Tom. Good to hear from you. Janice from Pittsburgh to Pittsburgh. Janice in Pittsburgh, also listening to WPTT. Hey, Janice.
Hi, how are you?
Just good.
I am just calling to say that there can be no healing as far as I'm concerned. I'm going to stay a Democrat only because in Pennsylvania you can't vote in the primary unless you're registered.
Right.
So, but I will, if it actually gets close here, I will vote for John McCain, if it got close. If not, I will.
You mean if Hillary Clinton is not the nominee?
Yeah, it's just been too much. And also, my 13-year-old biracial daughter says that she can't stand him either. I can't let her down. She watched what happened to Hillary, and I can't let her down. I can't let myself down. I can't do this. I can't do it anymore.
So, Janice, how would you – so what you're saying is that you're a Hillary supporter who will never vote for Barack Obama, period. In fact, you will vote for John McCain. You'll vote against Obama. What if Hillary is the vice president?
No, I would not vote for that ticket. I'm sorry. I can't. To me, I can't do that. He does not have the experience. We watched him get away with so much stuff and her just be dragged through the mud. It was so unfair. I can't believe how unfair.
Very interesting. Okay, Janice, thank you very much for your thoughts. I have a caller here in Linwood, Washington. I'm sorry your name just dropped off the screen. But I think that you might have just heard that you're on the air in Linwood, Washington.
Yeah. Yes, this is Diane.
Hi, Diane.
From Linwood, Washington.
Thanks. We just have a minute before the break, Diane.
Pardon?
We just have a minute before the break.
Okay. It's time to put on our big boy pants and our big girl pants and get the Democratic Party together. I had a great experience on Saturday at the Congressional District Caucus. I'm a Hillary supporter, delegate, and I talked to an Obama delegate. We had a great half-hour conversation about issues and where do we go from here? How do we get together? My issue is holding people's feet to the fire, whoever the nominee is, to get universal health care. Thank you for great talking points. I shared with a lot of people on Saturday the real story behind AARP and how much their CEO makes, and the fact that they're an insurance company.
Yeah, that's a whole other issue. But I, you know, thank you very much for the call, and it's great. I mean, this is so wonderful to hear a Clinton delegate sitting down for a half hour and talking with an Obama delegate and the healing. The call, Janice in Pittsburgh, the previous caller. It really concerns me to hear that, and I understand your passion. I get it. And we have to figure out a way to heal this party. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
I want my country back the way it was when I was young, when a man could be a Christian and not be Republican, when the trades we made with China weren't so hopelessly unfair, when made in China wasn't found on everything we wear.
9.5 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, and we have a winner in our contest for the day for the... I don't want to say that. For Sean's favorite post over at TomHartman.com on today's show blog. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. Today's choice comes from Pacific Coast Ron, who says, the short word you and Cliff Schechter were looking for to describe John McCain being lobbied up is sold out. For the last 3 weeks, he's been driving around with a big sign on the back of his car that says, McCain, not just any old warmonger, a confused, sold-out, angry warmonger. And no one's given him any angry hand gestures yet.
That's great. Okay. Thank you very much, Sean.
Thanks, Tom.
And the winner, again, I'm sorry, was?
Pacific Coast Ron.
So Pacific Coast Ron, congratulations to Pacific Coast Ron. He wins a copy of Walking Your Blues Away. A copy of Walking Your Blues Away, How to Heal the Mind and Create Emotional Well-Being by Tom Hartman, of all things. Who would have thought? 866-303-2270, your telephone number. And Judy in New Jersey. Hey, Judy, what's up?
Well, I listened to a caller who was so disappointed about Clinton and didn't want to vote for anyone else. And
it went beyond that. She said she would vote for John McCain.
I don't get it. I'm sorry. I mean, among other things, I didn't start out disliking Clinton. I lived in New York. She was my senator. Full disclosure, she was never my candidate because I think she lacks a certain flexibility. Once she's a very bright woman and has wonderful ideas, but it's her ideas get a little fixed. And I think we need someone a little more flexible. But beside the point, as you yourself said on many occasions, she kept hitting below the belt. She kept striking at Obama in ways which he never struck at her. And Hillary is a victim. I'm sorry. I just saw her. Yeah, sexism is alive and well, and we all deal with it. Hillary and I are almost exactly the same age. We came up in the same time. We took different paths. But that's not the real problem here. The problem is that she has acted crazy, and she's tried to have it both ways. One time she's the villain, and she's tearing up.
No, I get it. I get
it,
Judy.
And then she's the tough little pit bull.
But see, people have multiple dimensions to their personalities. That's an okay thing. But what's your bottom line?
My bottom line is my plan, had Hillary won the nomination, was to hold my nose and vote for her and think of Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And Democrats should get a grip. And John McCain is a very bad man.
Yeah,
and
well
this,
said.
And this cute grandfather is a not real person.
Yeah. No, Judy, very well said. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Marcy in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening to KTRC.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Marcy.
Three very short points. One, this is not homecoming queen or student council election. Two, both Obama and Hillary are trying to win. So they're going to do things and say things that will help them get the votes at the moment. But the third point is there will be nothing to, quote, come together with, you know, at the end of this, because they are virtually the same on so many positions.
Right. And there are very few differences in their policies.
Compared
to
McCain.
And worldview.
Oh, my God. Compared to McCain, especially.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Thanks,
well said. Thank you, Marcy. Kay in Austin, Texas. Hey, Kay.
Hi. I think they differ in their followings. Obama is spreading a message of change and uniting the country, and I think that Clinton has way too much, extremists following, and the Republicans, they're, my father being one, him, you know, just following the hatred that goes, that stems very deep to the Clintons. I know a lot of Republicans that will not switch over. They, and I know some that will, have actually changed over to the Democratic Party in favor of Obama, but they will not switch over if Clinton is on the ticket. But I'd like to recommend somebody who I think would bring together the country.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck Hagel, for example, somebody that would maybe appeal to the right side, who's stood up against the war.
Chuck Hagel has been a good moderate Republican. Does it give you pause to know that Chuck Hagel was the CEO of the company that became ES&S, the voting machine company that counts most of the votes in America?
Yeah. That would
maybe that's the downside, and maybe that's also the upside.
Chuck Hagel, but I'm just saying, for an example, we need to find somebody who could bring more voters from the other side and who would not turn them off.
No, well said. Well said.
On the, just real quick regarding the subject of torture,
mm-hmm.
I really recommend the movie Rendition, and
yes.
We really need to get our rights back.
Yes, absolutely. And we need to get our sensibilities back. We need to go back to the values that built this country. Thank you very much, Kay. Gene in Southern California listening on K-Talk. Hey, Gene. Gene, you are on the air. Gene is not there. Okay, let's go.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Gene, I'm sorry. I pushed the button fingers faster than mouth. Stephen in Danville, California on Green 960. Hey, Stephen.
Tom, how are you? Let me say a couple of things real quick before I get to my main point. If you just Google air car, there's a compressed air vehicle that uses no energy other than compressed air. They've got one with a backup.
Right, but where do you get the energy to compress the air?
Well, you're supposed to go to a compressed air station.
So where do they get the energy to compress the
air?
Well,
it's electricity.
Yeah, okay.
But
it doesn't
burn.
So compressed air is a means of storing energy, basically.
Just like
hydrogen would be.
And they've got a later version that's still a prototype with a lawnmower engine in the back that if you're out in the road, it compresses the air. And that's got to be probably even more miles per gallon than what we're getting out of the electric
except that
cars.
It's running all the time that you're not driving so that it can compress the air so the air is available when you are driving.
Well, beyond a certain amount, yes.
Yeah. But your main point, because we've just got a few seconds before the show is over today.
My main point was we're talking about John Yoo, and I don't know if you saw the 60 Minutes segment with John Scalia or Antonin Scalia.
I did, and Scalia is just as bad as Yoo is.
He's worse. He says we could draw and quarter people so long as we're getting information out of them, not punishing them.
Right, yeah.
He's for moral turpitude.
I agree with you, Stephen. I agree with you. And he should be impeached for the role he played in 2000. Oh, my. Coming up tomorrow, I have lost my sheet. Here it is. Coming up tomorrow, Mark Dice of the Renaissance is going to be talking about why his group is boycotting the logo on Starbucks coffee cups. It's going to be an entertaining day. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.